This is Waris Hussein, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Yeah?
I'm Josh Liston from On The Bubble Podcast, an oral history of television fandom, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other awesome geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
You've dialed into Gallifrey Public Radio. We're a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us for weekly discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and well beyond. Your hosts are Jay Witten.
I choose Death by Scotland.
Keir Hansen.
Arun, Arun, Arun.
And Hayley Malley.
Darth Vader, he's a villain, right?
We travel through classic and new Who, explore the extended Whovian universe, and play a few games from time to time if we're left unsupervised. Oh, and a word on spoilers, we do discuss recent news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but don't worry. If we look too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 335 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where our recipe calls for a little demonic ritual mixed with the right amount of pseudoscience info dump and the tiniest pinch of humor at the beginning and end of your dish. Oddly, it still looks and tastes like sea cucumber. The staff was nice enough, but they just keep staring at you. I'm Haley.
I'm Keir.
And I'm Jay, and this week, season 15 goes straight to occult horror, but tries to find a way to merge it with Time Lord interference, human evolution, and time fissures that explain ghostly phenomenon in The Image of the Fendal. It's a four-part story where the script editing was initially in the hands of Robert Holmes, but script rewrites at the last stages passed to the incoming editor, Anthony Reed. You might be able to see where the seams are.
Yeah. So there's a, as they are implying here, there is a lot sort of worked into this story. It's by no means any sort of a straight shot. Let's just go paranormal, or let's just go scientific, or let's just go do space travel. It's a real mixed bag, but we want to see how well it was executed. Haley, as first impressions and your first take on this story, how did the Image of the Fendal strike you?
There were a lot of elements that I really, really liked and wouldn't mind seeing again in another story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were some other things that didn't work as well for me.
Okay. We'll definitely unpack those. Jay, did you have a kind of a similar take?
Yeah, no, it was interesting. I enjoyed watching it. There was a lot of stuff that that really did captivate me, and other times where I'm like, okay, let's come on, move along. Let's get to the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay. I think this probably out of season 15, this is one of the stories that I go back to least frequently. But every time I do, it strikes me that the first two episodes really hit some, I guess you could say familiar, but really interesting chords right off the bat. You know, it's got this, the first episode in particular, you know, you talk about the horror story shtick that they're doing, from the way it's shot to how long scenes hold to the fact there's only about, I think, less than a minute of incidental music in the entire episode. And it's just a matter of everything is just conveyed by ambient noise and just obviously just the strict dialogue really sets a great tone. You know, and you think, oh, okay, I understand the premise from the beginning of this. Okay, you got the scientific team; they found this skull. It's older than human evolution should be, and this all sounds like the groundwork for some really kind of cool stuff. I just don't know if it got the work to carry it consistently through. Haley, you mentioned at the intro that there was that it's sort of like the humor aspect of it, which we normally would expect from this now much more comfortable Fourth Doctor and Leela pairing, doesn't stay consistent through. You get a little smidge of it at the beginning, you get a little button at the end, but their relationship in the in-between is a little unusual Did anybody else pick up on this?
They're separated a fair amount, too.
Mm.
Yeah, it definitely seemed to have been firing on more cylinders than it has been in a few of the previous stories. But yeah, it is very much like stutter stop. Like, it's like, okay, no, they're really clicking right here. This is great. And what happened? Where'd the other two go?
Yeah.
Like, it was very intermittent.
Yeah. You get to the point where I think it's the whole battle stations thing they're gearing up for in the fourth episode. And the Doctor even tells Leela, your position is just to essentially get out of the way, you know, stay out of the way, go away. It never ceases to strike me as unusual. I do like supporting cast in this, you know. I do like some of the fact that as some of my in-house critics were walking past the screen as I'm doing one of the rewatches earlier this week, Julie, who joined us last week, says, is everybody as over the top in this story as at the moment? I think she was seeing a conversation between Colby and Fendelman, and I said, you know, this story kind of needs it. I think this really lends itself to these kind of, you know, everybody at the top of their regional theater game. You know, everyone's speaking a little bit louder than they need to, and they're gesticulating a little bit more intensely than they necessarily would need to, realistically. But it's
they're performing stylized to the back of the room.
Yeah, yeah. It's stylized for this because everything is, you know, the drama and the tension is supposed to be amped up. Then I guess here's my question. If we all liked the idea of where the story gets its basis, you know, and finding out, okay, there's obviously there's some time manipulation or something that's happened that has caused these scientists to come across something that not only defies their scientific understanding, but it also has some tie-ins to the Time Lords. Oh, okay, so now we got that into the mix. All these things on paper should be adding up to a pretty interesting story start to finish. Where did you see it start to stumble a little bit?
You know, I don't know. It was more of a gradual thing for me where, because it did seem pretty cohesive, and I was buying all the pseudoscience and all the, you know, all the random things. I'm like, okay, I didn't quite get that, but I'm on board. Let's just see where it goes. And at some point I just kind of like, I knew, I was like, this isn't going to end at all in like any kind of cohesive fashion. It wasn't a moment where I realized it. It was just kind of, I gathered it over the course of I don't know.
Okay.
So one of the things I said was there are a lot of interesting ideas, but I feel like they didn't do a lot with them.
Okay.
So we get the idea of these time traveling, or not time traveling, but stuck in a time loop, malevolent beings, and there being, you know, a kind of rift or something like that into modern day Earth. But I don't know. I would have liked to see more of the effects that they had over time, maybe. Or we talk about Mrs. Tyler's visions, like maybe see more of the type of visions she had along the way or something.
There's a lot of telling and not a lot of showing through this.
Yeah.
And any one of those things, you could have tugged on any one of those threads and gotten a little more interesting thing to pursue maybe around episode three or so, because you talk about the info dumps and just a lot of the pseudoscience being handed out. It gets at one point, it really, like, you have to credit Baker for some of the monologues of things that he's got to spew forth. But, you know, when he starts getting into the talking about astral projection and race memory and all these things and how that has something to do with, you know, well, they tied deja vu into it, which seemed a little bit of an odd mix. But but any one of those things, you could say, okay, well, let's see this. And I think it kind of, for me personally, it culminates, it's unfortunate, when you actually see the Fendaline for the first time, because you want to see what makes this being so formidable. The Time Lords not only lock it away, but strike all record of it. You know, I mean, this is like violation of every one of their policies and things. And yet it's, you never really get the feeling of how formidable this adversary should be, other than the fact that they've got the telepathic control to be able to get your legs to lock. And they move really, really slowly.
Well, And the doctor says, you know, there's such a malevolent race that they've created whatever malevolence there is in mankind. They've influenced the evolution of mankind. Mm. And it's just kind of thrown out there. And it's like, that seems like a big deal to just throw out there and then never touch again.
Right. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I will say that I was totally on board with when Baker was engaged, he was on. It was brilliant because it's like when he was kind of freaked out about it, you got freaked out. And when he was like, oh, okay, I understand this. I'm not, you know, I'm calm now. You're like, okay, the doctor's got this. We're good. And you definitely did follow the doctor's mood throughout. Mm-hmm. But then there were times when Baker did his typical, like, he's there earning a paycheck and you're just kind of like, all right, let's get to the next scene. But when he was on, it was fantastic.
Right. I felt a little let down. But speaking specifically of Baker's performances, you know, and you see these moments of rage, like these outbursts, you know, him kicking boxes around and slamming the console and getting upset with himself. And we get some sort of explanation partway through where, you know, he's sort of breaking it down with Leela and she calls him out on it. And he divulges that it's a matter of being frightened in childhood by a mythological horror. And that it's something that's lingering with him, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of the of Listen, you know taking them to modern day. Mm-hmm. But in there, the story spends more time seeing the actual emotional and psychological impact on the doctor. It doesn't just sort of manifest itself as occasional outbursts of violence or lashing out verbally at characters and things. So it seemed like it didn't quite blend to what I considered acceptable. I would have more taken it as something where, you know, if he had had a run-in with this particular being before and had not come out on top, and that lingered with him, and that was something that was causing him when he starts to put two and two together and realize what he's up against. Now he's upset with himself because he had an opportunity at some point in the past to beat them or put them in check and failed to do so. I might have been better with that kind of a reaction. But yeah, I mean, when we talk about the fact that these Fendal are supposed to be, of such magnitude or of such ferocity that these great lengths have to be taken to, and then I'm not sure if I get an acceptable blending of how that works in with this town coven that's been pulled together. The fact that this area around the time Fisher has sort of lent itself to these local occult practices, I liked that. But then you finally get the Fendal core, right? Thea in her golden form. Mm-hmm. And this is supposed to be like godlike power. And I just don't see it.
Yeah, no, it was definitely kind of, it was much better on paper. Mm. But it...
It's like somebody wrote a book and then just turned it directly into the episode. Mm.
Did anyone else feel like Thea in her Fendal form was like almost the proto Weeping Angel? Like
kind of, yeah, don't look in the eyes, and yeah, sort of. They were pulling on Medusa a little bit, and it might have been something that lingers in Moffat's head when it came up with the angels later. Yeah, but the. I don't know, the paralysis aspect, the fact that when you get like Stahl realizes that his only solution at this point is to ask the doctor to bring him a gun. I mean, there are some dark aspects to this story. I mean, you've got Fendelman shot in the head, and you're looking at the corpse on screen, which is not something you often get. In classic Who, direct look at the corpse.
Right, complete with, like, bullet wound. That was the part that got me.
Yeah.
I was like, it wasn't just him laying on the floor. It was like, nope, there's, look, blood trickling down from where the, like, that was pretty intense for what we're getting.
Yeah, yeah. Fendelman, I thought, I liked where they were going with him. I'm still trying to figure out his accent. I don't quite.
That was kind of fun.
It wasn't German. It wasn't French. Belgian. Go Belgian, maybe. I don't know. But when you get to the point where it's in the final moments where, you know, he parses his own name, Fendelman, mm-hmm. man of the Fendal. Generations of my fathers have been manipulated. I'm like, what? I wanted more of this before. This mm-hmm. could have been great. This could have been a whole, you know, young Frankenstein thing going on here. But
well, and that I honestly, I was kind of waiting for that to come into play the whole time, because like you meet him and like after like the first time or two you hear his name, I'm like, oh, Fendelman. Okay, well, that's, he's going to be pivotal in all of this. And it just turned out to be a complete red herring. And I was like, wow, that's, I really bought him as the like, I was actually going to rage on it and be like, really, they're going to hide it under the name like that? And that's how you're going to disguise your bad guy or whatever. But then it turned out to be.
But he was a patsy. Absolutely. Well, not a patsy necessarily, but he was just a tool. And that I liked. I liked the fact that he wasn't the obvious. Oh, yeah. You know, because then you really come around to Colby, you know, digging Colby. Yeah.
I liked Colby. And I honestly, I liked Fendelman towards the end. Like, once you realize that he's not the bad guy that they kind of like hinted at that he was going to be at the beginning, mm-hmm. I kind of really started to like him, too. When he and Colby started working together, I was like, OK, I like this duo. I like this team. And unfortunately, it really didn't pay out the way that it could have.
Yeah.
But
so, OK, well, we've got some other pieces to this that I'm curious to get your take on. Our solution, Jay, you joked about this last week when we knew that we were teeing this one up, that this had the kind of the supernatural solution to it, because we're packing rock salt and going after, you know, monsters in the family business and whatnot. But did this solution to this creature that the Time Lords had to strike from the annals of history, but you could lob bottles of salt at it to keep it at bay long enough to implode the building?
All the Time Lords have high cholesterol, so they don't keep salt on Gallifrey.
Okay.
All right. Duh.
All right. I was wondering if they were going to go the slug route and say, well, you know, this was not only the origins of the dark side of man, this is actually where mollusks and slugs and mm-hmm. snails evolved from. So.
Hence the reason humans are so squidged out by them.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm still standing by that they are the Menomina creatures.
Great. Now that's stuck in my head. Thanks.
Yep. You're welcome.
In everybody's head.
I'll do
thanks.
A fan
thanks
edit.
A heap.
So they'll be dancing around with the Drashigs.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
No, it was kind of, it was just kind of like, all right, well, it seemed a little too commonplace to really be that effective. But at that point, I'd already been like, okay, this isn't going to wrap up decently. So let's just go with whatever they throw at it and see what happens. But I mean, you did get the fun little exchange between the Doctor and Leela, where he starts going into his whole scientific explanation of, oh, sodium chloride reacts with this, that, and the other.
Salt kills it.
And then Leela's like, salt hurts it. The Doctor's like, that's what I said.
Potato, potato. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just keep coming back to the fact that this is like one of those stories where it has all the pieces and somewhere it stumbles or it just doesn't deliver on some of the things that within the story itself it tees up. Like it pursues a couple aspects that maybe you thought might be better left just mentioned and forgotten and focus over on this other thing. Yeah, this great thing going. Let's work on this. And it never comes back around to it. So I don't know how I would end up rating this one. I mean, I guess I'll wait until we get to the sort of the rewatch and recommendation things. But all in all, I mean, where would you grade a story like this that comes out of the gate strong and sort of crosses the finish line limping a little bit?
It's hard to say. It's honestly, I got more enjoyment from the story after I started looking into it and finding some of the stuff, the behind the scenes things and stuff like that. Really, I was like, okay, this is really an interesting kind of thing. So I glommed onto it from there. But I enjoyed it much more after the fact than during the actual viewing.
Mm. Stick around for the DVD extras on this one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Haley, how did you feel about like the overall impressions, knowing, you know, where you began with it versus where you ended with it? I mean, is it, was it satisfactory, or do you consider it kind of disappointing, or?
Like I said, I think that there was a better episode in here than the one we got. There were just so many elements that were interesting that it was a little disappointing that they didn't use those to their fullest extent.
And that's kind of something that I've noticed being a trend lately with these classic rewatches, is that, like, you've got the bones of a fantastic story here. It's just there's something in the execution or something in the portrayal that just doesn't drive it to its full potential.
Is that just a filter of how we're looking at it, though, through a modern viewer lens, though?
And that might be the case. Yeah. Because, I mean, clearly there was something that drew people to this week after week.
Yeah, the viewership numbers rise. If you watch it across the four episodes, it starts from somewhere around like the high 6, low 7 million viewer mark, and it ends up around 9.1, 9.2 million viewers by the fourth installment. So,
It makes me wonder what people are going to think watching New Who 30 years from now.
I wonder if part of it is that, you know, they were cranking these out, and they had to build these four stories, and they didn't necessarily get to go back to part one when they realized what they wanted to do in part four. If it was just part of the nature of the way they were producing the show at the time, that this is kind of what happened.
That may have been a factor, but it's also, I think Jay hit it when he was mentioning earlier about the change of the editors, script editors for this. This was Robert Holmes' walk away, you know, and he had been at the helm for some time now, overseeing the continuity and solidity of the scripts as his writers were turning them over. And Chris Boucher, one of them, writing not only for Hinchcliffe, but a predecessor as well. But handing it over midstream, I guess he had some sort of there was a conflict of timing as Boucher was actually leaving to go become story editor for Blake 7. So they bring in Anthony Reed to take over for Robert Holmes as well. So you've got the writer, the originating writer, unavailable. Robert Holmes is stepping back from the position, even though he's credited for the story. It's actually Anthony Reed who finishes up. And from what I understand from backstory, Reed was much more apt to say, you know what, just lay the information out here, and then we'll do some action sequences, and we'll have some dialogue that'll pepper it up later. So you get more of the info dumps that were not normally indicative of Robert Holmes's script editing. He wanted to see more of a smooth release, or, you know, time release of the information, so that it felt a little bit more natural and not so stop and go. This, I think, by the time you get to the last couple episodes, is exactly what happens. The doctor suddenly just, you know, bangs out this bit of information about how science and magic and the occult and the paranormal, and they're all related, and then some crazy stuff happens, and then you need to have some action, and Leela needs to, you know, run around in her, you know, her more limited dress now for a while, and spend a lot of time lingering on her visually. And then they're going to do another info dump, and the cycle repeats. And that's where I start to push back and say, guys, this isn't the quality level that you're capable of. You're making some rookie mistakes here.
And this is kind of the one thing that stood out to me, really, was the fact that you had the doctor and Colby. When doctor was explaining everything to Colby, it really struck me as, like, this is the kind of thing that you expect to have the companion, that, like, this is the role you expect the companion to fill. And the fact that Leela's off just, you know, basically being eye candy so that, you know, we can actually talk real information. I understand the problem of, you know, Leela is a quote unquote savage. And so she wouldn't ask the questions that Colby was asking so I started seeing where that's really becoming a problem with the kind of stories that these writers want to tell,
right,
and how Leela becomes more of an obstacle than an asset.
Right.
And it would have been very easy to get away from it, or to somehow get her to be the one that's in that situation. But it was so much easier and so much more believable to have this scientist asking these questions and understanding what it is the doctor's relaying to him without dumbing it down to a third grade level or something.
That's really unfortunate, because they had been, over the last couple of stories, starting to establish that Leela is not ignorant by any means, and that the fact that she sees things through a much different lens proves beneficial 9 times out of 10. So
right.
This is a bit of a step back, as far as I see it in that regard.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. But it's at the same time, like, I can start to see everything unwinding, and there's definitely people involved in making the show that are like, why are we hamstringing ourselves like this? Mm. And you can tell that it's going to come undone real quick.
Right.
Well, they need her there so she can follow her feelings to the doctor being in danger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least you do get that exchange where she actually feels like she saved the doctor at one point. You can see the yeah. glee.
It's like, I saved your life, didn't I? Yes, you did.
Okay. Yeah. We'll put a small check in the W column there for you. yes, yeah, so Jay, I'm right with you as far as the some of the interesting things that you can find if you choose to dig a little deeper into the story. There's a ton of extra trivia related with the production and the execution of this particular story that you could have a lot of fun with. What were some of the standouts for you? I mean, I know the obvious one for me personally.
Well, and most of them revolve around this, but for modern viewers like us right now, especially given everything that's just happened in the theatrical world recently, the Wanda Ventham, who played Thea, looked really familiar to me at first, and I could not figure out why. I was like, okay, just generic 70s actress, whatever. And it wasn't until like I started really looking closer at her, and I'm like, that's a wig. She is absolutely wearing a wig. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of clicked into place for me, and I realized who this woman is. And so she is actually Benedict Cumberbatch's mother.
Yes.
So she's been in a lot of other things, naturally has blonde hair, but they thought that with the gold paint that she wears later, the blonde hair would become, it would blend too much and it wouldn't be as distinct a change.
Mm-hmm.
So they had her wear the brunette wig the whole time. but this actually started filming, the production block where they filmed this story was, I believe it was August of 77.
Mm-hmm.
It was July of 77. So at this point, Benedict Cumberbatch is just over a year old. So headcanon is that we have a young Benedict Cumberbatch running around backstage in Doctor Who. So I'm, you know what?
Crawling around.
Given his proximity to Stephen Moffat and this now, I'm absolutely, I mean, just come on the show and make it official.
Yep.
Come on, Benny. Yep. But the, one of the fun things I found about Wanda Ventham though, is that she actually, her role in this was that she was, she had actually tried out to be Jill Masterson in Goldfinger, but obviously lost it out to Shirley Eaton. So getting to be in this and painted gold kind of just closed that circle.
Nice. I see what you did there.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So yeah, it was just some interesting stuff, digging into her career and seeing what was going on there. But
yeah, it is cool. And for anyone who questioned why, the couple things right from the opening sequences, well, the first sequences within the TARDIS. So when we finally see our TARDIS team in the first episode, and you're like, well, okay, K-9's in pieces. That doesn't make any sense. Doctor and Leela having a conversation about the gender of the TARDIS, which is hilarious to watch now. But Leela's standing there like, wait a minute. Her outfit's changed. Her hair is all wonky. What's going on here? And they give very, very little explanation over the whole thing. Well, the whole rationale behind it is just a great little story to pursue in the first place. So I guess a bad haircut leads to Leela having to wear her hair pinned up through the entire thing because 6 inches got cut off her hair and it looked completely, I guess it looked completely out of character when it was down. So the only way that you see it back worn down by the final story is because that scene was shot 5 weeks later and gives a chance for it to grow out a bit. And the change of the outfit was, I guess, because the leather outfit that she had been her go-to was falling apart. from where, and it was uncomfortable for Louise Jameson to wear because it was a full leotard. So for a lot of sequences, especially location shoots and things, it was extremely uncomfortable, especially as it was disintegrating. So they went with something that instead of a leotard was actually a functional dress. And then the obvious reason that they were just trying to increase sex appeal. But they bring it back. I'm not sure exactly why they brought it back in the final scene, unless it was a matter of just to sort of punctuate the joke about the fact that, you know, the doctor just barely notices in the first scene that she's changed her dress, and he kind of throws it in there as a way to distract her from the disparaging comments he keeps making about the Seva team and their intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. Like, it seemed really odd that they kind of, like, tagged that on at the end, and it did. It seemed really disjointed from the rest of it. So it... And the fact that that Canine was in pieces at the beginning, and then they never really explained why, and it never got, it never got brought up.
Well, the reason why is because they didn't want to use him in this episode.
Yeah, they're trying to establish a thing because they realize the Canine has appeal to the viewers, but they probably didn't want to pay John Leeson for that episode. So don't write any lines. Just get the robot to nod its head up and down at the end. That'll be the button on the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right. So rewatchability and recommendability. Haley, I'm gonna look to you on this one.
I could rewatch it. I don't know if I could recommend it though, because the end is not as strong as other parts of it. I did really like Mrs. Tyler though.
Yeah.
Like.
Oh yeah.
Just too old for this shit, Grandma.
She's fantastic. Actually, yeah, I liked her grandson too. I liked Jack Tyler. I thought the two of them, they were a great little pair.
Yeah, it did kind of take me a minute.
It would be great if Rose was descended from this set of Tylers.
Jackie.
Headcanon accepted.
Yeah. It's Jackie's grand.
It did throw me off though that for a minute there when, because Gran keeps on calling him John and the doctor keeps calling him Jack, and there was a moment of disconnect there before I was like, oh, right, Jack is a nickname for John, which, yeah.
Doesn't make any sense because it's the same number of letters and the same number of syllables.
Yeah, but I actually like listened to another podcast where they talked about how nicknames work, and they kind of went into that and that same kind of rant where it was like, yeah, it's why is that even a thing? How is it even close? And this and it's kind of the language between the things. So
right,
sounds like stuff you should know how nicknames work.
Right.
Yeah. Kind of, it's more interesting than you'd think.
So, all right. Jay, would you concur with this as far as, you know, you might go back to rewatch it, maybe to see some things that that went by a little quickly, especially in those information dumps.
I could definitely see myself rewatching it. Maybe not a high rewatchability factor, but it's definitely there. As far as recommendability, know your audience. If you have someone that's really a fan of classic horror and stuff, yeah, absolutely. And classic horror meaning like thrillers and stuff, not Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely this, there's a lot of stuff that could appeal to somebody here.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, know your audience. But beyond that, it's not very indicative of what typical Doctor Who is. It's not really indicative of this era of Doctor Who. Yeah. So yeah, without them being... a fan of the genre, I don't see myself recommending it.
Understood. Yeah, I got to agree. If it's on as a marathon, sure, I'm going to watch it for continuity and keep going through. Fendall do get explored a little bit further in some books and I think maybe one or two audio productions total. But they do actually, I think in one of the books you do get a little bit more with Colby and see what kind of some of the aftermath of him witnessing all of this. And then the disposal of the skull, I think actually gets explored a little further too, you know, tossing it into the supernova. So,
I really would not have minded Colby becoming a proper companion.
Along the lines of a Harry?
Almost, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how it would have actually worked in the story that they have going on right now, but he is the kind of companion that, like, I would not mind seeing him join the team.
Gotcha.
He was dynamic enough, charismatic enough that it I could see that becoming more than just a one-off thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But well, there you have it.
All right. So are we ready to get into the news then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Sure.
Okay, I have a caveat with this one.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it from the headline. I fell into the clickbait. And I guess technically it is still sort of accurate insofar as saying that you could, you know, take part in this auction to win David Tennant's sand shoes.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not technically his. They're his stunt doubles.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah. That's the thing. So, yeah, if, you know, if you're willing to put down, you know, $200, $300, maybe $400 or so, about 10 days from the day we're recording here, Eubank Auctions are going to be auctioning off a ton of props. And among them is a sizable lot of Doctor Who material. But the sneakers are not actually going to be David's, because the one David wore on set were David's shoes. He takes them home. So I don't know. So it's as close as you can get to a pair that could be used on Doctor Who and all.
These are great for someone who needs like 100% authenticity in their cosplay.
Yes. These ran across the set.
Yeah. Yep. These would be absolutely perfect for that. But just for the random fan who wants something that, you know, it's no, mm-hmm. You're okay just going and buying yourself your own white Converse and, you know, distressing them to yourselves.
Yeah. I think it's worth the owning, because like the establishment of those sneakers and the article actually brings this up, is that David was the one that was able to strong arm the wearing of them in the first place. The costume department had him set up for a pair of shiny boots.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely appeal in it, but you have to know what you're going in buying. Just
yeah.
There are definitely people that, you know, would love those. I would love those, but I'm not going to spend that kind of money on it.
You know, right.
Had they been on David Tennant's feet, then I don't know. That still makes it weird. So
then they would be more expensive, and you wouldn't be able to afford them.
Yeah, there's that too.
Yeah, you'd add a zero to it essentially. Mm-hmm. I think, but then you'd have some of his DNA, and you could do things with it. Like grow a hand.
Still not making it any less creepy.
Make a handy doctor. A toey doctor.
A toey. Oh. All right. Well, and in other news completely unrelated to scraping the bottom of David Tennant's feet, you can... we talked... It was only maybe a month ago we were talking about the fact that they were doing a little VR thing for Doctor Who, and it was the Runaway thing that was only like a 15
less than
minute
a month, actually. Yeah.
Well, that was apparently just a taste of what was in the works.
Yeah. So I'm not sure who the team is behind this, but we actually have a full length Doctor Who VR game called The Edge of Time that is set to be dropping later this year.
Yeah. It's supposed to be like upwards of hours worth of a VR play, which is kind of cool. I mean, I don't know. I've only messed with a handful of VR games, but they normally aren't something that you can, just because I don't think your inner ear can handle it for too long of being in these things for more than about 30, 45 minutes at a time. But this is supposed to be
hours. Definitely not your marathon gaming. Yeah. But yeah, no, it really seems interesting. It's so the Runaway that we talked about before has more of a cartoony vibe to it. It's definitely... geared more towards like the people that are used to the casual things or something like that. The people that are really big into Fortnite, you know, are used to that kind of aesthetic. This has a much more realistic feel to it.
Yeah, which is disturbing.
Given the context, yes, it is. If you haven't seen it yet, go and check out the trailer that they've put out. It's just a little teaser. It's a few seconds, but... even without the VR headset, it was enough to make me scream like a little girl at one point.
Yep. Because you will be squaring off against adversaries old and new. Mm-hmm. And some of the recognizable names are not things that you want in a mask wrapping around your face in full.
And coming at you at high speed.
Yeah. So
yeah.
I now I don't own a VR kit. I know that this is going to be actually available for a handful of platforms, you know, PlayStation VR, Oculus Rift, the HTC Vive and those things. But I might have to consider this now. I might have to go the PlayStation VR route and add that on to the home kit.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're actually, VR games are really starting to come into their own. And they're getting mass appeal from big name studios. And so this is a good indication of how that's kind of coming about.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
I think the production studio involved is Maze Theory, because as I was looking through some of the names sort of associated with the gallery of images that were released with this teaser trailer, that name came up, and then I dug a little deeper on that one, and they're also connected to a VR game about the Peaky Blinders series that's actually due next year. So sounds like this is kind of their thing, is to take cinematic platforms and apply them to VR experiences. So, or not, well, cinematic, but I should say, you know, entertainment-based platforms.
Licensed material.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check this out. This seems right up my alley. So. Yeah.
From the sound experience, too, can you imagine having the full immersion? Because if Akinola's script is, or if his compositions are actually used as some of the incidental and the all your ambience music, I think that'd be really, really cool.
Now, the one thing that I can't find a real clue on how this is going to play out, but it says in the article that it's actually starring Jodie Whittaker. Mm. So I don't know. Or do you play as the Doctor? Do you come across her? I don't know how this is going to pull into it, but she's actually in the game.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of tie this in, and whether they've got a decent story to go along with the sheer jump scares that they're going to cram into it.
Oh, sure. Sure. Well, there are a handful of review articles out there since the trailer dropped today. So a couple of the different publications out there have slightly different takes on it. If you do a little ancillary walking on the articles, you might be able to find something that explains what her involvement is, or whether it's just a matter of similar to some of the other games we've played recently, where you've got the main character that comes in every once in a while and says, "Good job, keep it going." And then they walk off again. Thanks. Right.
You know, if that's all it is, I could use a little like Jodie Whittaker just popping into the room being like, "Hey, you're doing great." Like that, I'm okay with that. That I need that in my life.
There you go.
All right. Well, next week we're going to be coming back to our Torchwood rewatch with episode 2 of season 1.
Yep.
So getting back at this and seeing where Jack and the team go from here. So.
Oh, and thank you to the handful of folks who have been willing to admit that they have never seen Torchwood and are using this as their opportunity to go out and check it out for the first time. Now, granted, they have to go out and actually purchase it in order to acquire it, because it's not readily available for any streaming services. But they're making that investment as well. So even more betterer. They're adding to their library and to their viewing experience. Plus, now with Game of Thrones done, what else you got to watch?
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, this has been episode 335 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, "Hey, I found this really old skull. I'm going to go and put it on my head and see what happens."
Works just fine. Yep. And this is Kira saying, you know, if you ever find yourself locked in a storeroom later on, you know, try the lock a few times, kick some boxes around, and then just stand there and wait for about a full minute, because odds are really good that for no reason whatsoever, a prop guy is just going to open the door for you.
You know, I don't think those cows know anything about the time scanner.
We'll see you guys next week.
And we'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.